Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Explaining History podcast, and today I'm going to talk about prohibition in America in the 1920s and the violence and gangsterism that goes with it. One of the reasons why I want to talk about this isn't particularly because of a fascination with, you know, guys with Tommy guns in violin cases or anything like that. It's because there is something about prohibition that draws out this immense contradiction within American society and this immense debate over the role of the state, the idea of what freedom means in America, what the freedom to make personal choices really is all about. In the USA, and where the limitations of that lie, and the idea that prohibition really is this, in some ways, a strange aberration, but also part of a kind of a long and ongoing history of the control of public behaviours. That can obviously be seen in other kinds of prohibition, such as the war on drugs. The curious thing about prohibition is there seems to be lacking, really, a sufficient body of opinion in America that's in favour of it, and though it lasts for 15 years. Now, in the run-up to the 18th Amendment in 1918 and the Volstead Act, both of which... The 18th Amendment bans the sale, transportation, and manufacture of alcohol within America. And the Volstead Act defines intoxicating liquor as any drink containing more than 0.5% alcohol. And hands the responsibility for enforcement over to the Treasury. The forces behind the Volstead Act and the 18th Amendment with this curious coalition of women's groups, women's suffrage groups, who equated, in many cases with a great deal of accuracy, alcoholism and the oppression of women. Women were, and still are, far more likely to be the victims of domestic violence when alcohol is involved. Women who had, you know, no social safety net beneath them, and a drunken husband in tow, were left often destitute when the week's wages are spent at a saloon bar. Now, this is to ignore the fact that alcoholism is obviously no respecter of gender, and there were large numbers of women alcoholics in America as well. But normally, because of social propriety and that kind of thing, there were disproportionately large numbers of working class, or kind of what you would call underclass women, particularly from different non-white ethnicities who were more likely to have problems with alcohol. This were kind of marginalised, just as with the suffrage movement in Great Britain. The suffrage movement in America and the movements towards greater female emancipation was predominantly a well-to-do and rather virtuous middle-class affair. Business, actually, particularly the likes of Heinz, Rockefeller and Ford, saw drunkenness as leading to danger and inefficiency in the workplace. The growth of mass society and the growth of mass manufacturing industrialization in America, and the newness of this mass consumption society, meant that old methods of social behavior and social interacting, which of course is always lubricated by alcohol, became increasingly challenged. This is the era not of just Fordism, the production line, but of Frederick Winslow Taylor, who was the first man to create a science out of what is now known as time and motion studies, how efficiently an individual moves within the workplace between different parts of a production line or different parts of an office. And I mean, Lenin, actually, interestingly, was fascinated by the work of F.W. Taylor and thought that it presented all sorts of interesting solutions to the Soviet workplace and how we could really make people operate more like machines. Well, the hungover worker doesn't really have much of a place in F.W. Taylor's world. And the evidence was that if Taylorist principles were followed to the letter, then profits would rise. And so alcoholism was seen as a threat to profit. America, as the premier capitalist nation of the early 20th century, or I think most of the 20th century really, was a place whereby the idea of maximising returns, as is always kind of enshrined and encoded into capitalist societies, was an article of almost secular faith in America. So the hungover worker wasn't going to compete with that one. And the fact that America is a deeply religious society, and that some kind of government moral intervention, a moral regulation or moral correction, was seen as necessary on behalf of religious groups who thought that alcohol was the devil's work. Alcohol had been an integral part of the development of the West, the taming of America between the 1860s and the 1900s. It's been part of the kind of the unseemly side of frontier society, and as that world is swept away by the railroads and the railways, a more puritanical, more abstemious culture begins to develop. So Prohibition supporters were generally Protestant. They lived generally in the South and the West, and generally voted Republican. Most of the opponents were likely to be urban, of non-Northern European ethnic origin, Roman Catholic, and Democrat voting. And the Prohibition movement develops really from the Progressive Era, this point in American history from the 1890s through to the First World War, where social reform and a taming of the kind of the wilder excesses of American capitalism, plus the seemingly endless success of American capital, seemed to present America with a virtuous faith in all that seemed reasonable, and the belief that human endeavor and human logic and science and rationality could solve any problem, and that America was indeed a blessed and civilized society. And the progressive movement, one of their articles of faith was that alcohol abuse was responsible for social problems that could be alleviated, indeed removed, with the removal of alcohol. So by 1917, 27 states had already passed prohibition laws, and there were dry counties where alcohol was not allowed in several of the states. Two factors actually have a huge impact on the prohibition movement, and the first is obviously the First World War. During the First World War, there is an immense boost for prohibition, because grain that was used to make a whiskey is used instead for food. So the materials for distilling alcohol aren't there. It's not that they are that there is a total dearth of grain. It's just that the prohibition movement was able to make the argument that giving up alcohol was patriotic. In 1917, the Lever Act bans the use of grain in the manufacture of alcoholic drinks. Many of the large brewers, such as Pabst and Lieber, were German. Even if you look at American brewers now, I mean, the largest one is Anheuser-Busch, which again is of German origin, probably owned by all manner of global conglomerates now. Their businesses had been contributors to the National German-American Alliance, which had been a keen supporter of German interests before the war, as German diasporas in America would have been keen to make positive connections between America and the old country, as most other diaspora organisations did. During the war, obviously, anti-German feeling runs very high, not least because of acts of sabotage like the explosion at Black Tom Pier in New York in 1917. During the war, many people thought that a restrained behaviour, which involved less drinking, would be part of the war effort, but also would give an indication that America was a serious country, and that America in the post-war world, which would have to be completely reorganised, would be essentially a sober country, and that young soldiers who were sent off to fight should A, not be supplied with alcohol, and B, should not have to look back at American people on the home front behaving drunkenly. And that they were away from home for the first time and would, be tempted by sinful behaviours, and, a good example from home would help with all of that. Obviously, this is the kind of behaviour and action, these are the kinds of attitudes that you'd find among people who are already convinced. So people who are already on the kind of the religiously evangelical side of things. But it does suggest a certain kind of degree of naivety about world affairs, hoping that your soldiers don't fall into temptation when they go off to the trenches in France. The biggest organisation involved in prohibition was the Anti-Saloon League, which had a $5 million budget. But for all the Anti-Saloon League's efforts in putting pressure on congressmen and indeed on the presidency to enforce anti-alcohol policies, it becomes virtually impossible. America's got 18,700 miles of coastline and land border. There are waters that are in the waters just outside national limits. Smugglers essentially queue up to land their ships. Often this is referred to as rum row. Smuggling is so incredibly successful due to really a lack of resources to stop it, that the officer in charge of prohibition enforcement guessed that agents only intercepted about 5% of the alcohol coming into the country illegally. In 1924, $40 million worth of alcohol was seized, and the actual volume of business was thought to be $800 million. So one of the best industries to be in. There were, even if you weren't catching whiskey coming in from Canada or rum coming in from the Caribbean, there were professional chemists in a sort of a prefiguring of Breaking Bad who were still able to sell medicinal alcohol. But this was obviously open to abuse, and that you would find bootleggers who would go into business and they would produce and distribute illegal alcohol. The most significant of these was George Remus, who bought up a range of different breweries, and he did that just before the Volstead Act was passed.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And then once he had controlled these breweries, he made sure that he had 3,000 gangsters at his disposal to make sure his products went to illegal stills. He would essentially hijack his own products, send them to illegal stills in big cities, and give the impression that he was the one who'd been robbed. A more dangerous source of alcohol was industrial alcohol, so industrial ethanol. If by accident people consume methanol, they would go blind and then probably die. But industrial ethanol is extremely, extremely potent. Obviously, you know, you drink a glass of vodka and what you have essentially is ethanol and water, and some other flavourings or what have you. But industrial alcohol was easily stolen from industrial processes or diverted away, and it was turned to moonshine. Referred to because often it was manufactured in the hills, in rural areas, under cover of darkness. That's where the term comes from. The danger for drinkers, obviously, was alcohol poisoning, and there were one of the reasons for the creation of the modern cocktail was to try to use fruit juices various to disguise the smell of this potent stuff. One of the more common forms of moonshine was wood alcohol, and that we were more likely than not to accidentally make methanol, which would kill you. Treasury agents found it very difficult to enforce prohibition. There were 3,000 of them were employed to do so. They were poorly paid, so they were on average salary of around $2,500, and they were tasked with the job of closing down a business that turned over $2 billion a year. So they're easily corrupted. There were federal agents who, on the side, became essentially millionaires by licensing certain establishments and ensuring that certain gangsters knew that they would always look the other way. The dry lobby amongst the prohibition supporters was extremely well organised, but again lacked the ability to practically enforce the policies that they had campaigned for. The Anti-Saloon League is actually quite divided. Some members wanted ever stricter enforcement laws with longer jail sentences and heavier punishments. Others thought that the league itself should be given power over the appointment of federal agents to prosecute bootleggers. But the more progressive side thought that surely the only way that you can bring about change is instead of punishing endlessly is to focus on education and trying to bring help people to avoid drinking in the first place. Congress perhaps didn't do very much to enforce prohibition because it didn't want to get on the nerves of rich voters who they knew were busy breaking prohibition laws anyway. There was a period whereby federal government's role reduced, and the post Wilsonian era, where big government, as it periodically does in America, comes under intense attack, and the idea that the state is overfunded and overstaffed becomes quite prevalent in American discourse. The apparent popularity of speakeasies, these hidden drinking dens, was evidence enough to congressmen that Americans liked to have a drink, and prohibition was unenforceable. But this is really the elephant in the room, something that wasn't allowed to really be articulated. And obviously the huge upsurge in gangsterism and crime after a $2 billion a year trade is put in the hands of criminals, leads to an immense amount of violence, and the ability of gangsters to flourish in terms of their businesses and diversify and put finances into different things, such as prostitution and later heroin. Of course, gangsters do what every capitalist really hopes to do and establishes a monopoly. The Al Capone, in his various writings, when he's interviewed, he says, "Oh, you know, I'm a patriot. I'm an American who does what America's all about. I'm a businessman, and America is all about business and the making of money. And so I should be seen as a national treasure." The monopolies that were created in places like Chicago and Cicero, in New Jersey and New York, were violently defended. So, for example, Johnny Torrio was one of the most successful crime lords in Chicago. And had managed to amass something like about $30 million by the time he retired and handed over to Al Capone in 1925. Al Capone, obviously the most notorious of the gangsters of that period, not only combines his empire and expands it and develops it into a nationwide outfit, but becomes also, his ego results in him becoming a kind of a celebrated figure, so as much as the Cray twins did in the 1960s in Great Britain. He became a media star, and he saw himself as, you know, a figure of free enterprise, and he thought that he was doing very little wrong. He's a Republican, and was, in a way, the Republicans, by favouring prohibition, had actually made Al Capone the man who he was. Obviously, he is jailed in 1932 for income tax evasion, but had amassed about $70 million in the end. He said that, well, you know, I never forced anyone to have a drink or sleep with one of my prostitutes. This is all perfectly voluntary and people are free to choose these sorts of things. It just happens to make me awfully rich. The fact that Al Capone had large numbers of people killed in order to build his empire, I suppose, was rather here nor there. Johnny Torrio had been a gangster of a kind of an earlier era, one who had used violence from time to time, but mainly had negotiated with his enemies, the Irish gangsters, the O'Banions, in New York, in Chicago. And the development that really caused all sorts of problems was when Chicago acquires an honest police chief who prosecuted gangsters and managed to prevent bootleggers from making much of a profit. These financial pressures meant that gangsters, in order to maintain a certain standard of living, had to move into each other's territories. There now was a smaller cake for everyone to have a slice of. They, seeking to maximise their profits, they led to a period in Chicago history of about 5 years where 300 murders are committed. And Chicago, in Chicago and Cicero next door, Al Capone builds up a force of about 700 enforcers and spies. So there was really, he really was the de facto ruler of Chicago. His most outrageous and audacious and murderous act was on Valentine's Day of 1929, when five of his men, who were dressed as policemen, arrested seven members of Bugs Moran's gang and shot them. It became the infamous St. Valentine's Day Massacre. In the 3 years from 1927 to 1930, there were 227 gangland killings in Chicago, and only two killers were ever convicted. Prohibition doesn't exactly create organised crime, but it certainly gives organised crime a massive amount of power and energy. And when organised crime, when prohibition ends, organised crime doesn't go away. It simply diversifies into new areas because it has had a decade or 15 years of the most extraordinary training in how to build criminal enterprises and criminal empires. And the new areas to move into were gambling, and later prostitution, and later drugs. And so the modern mafia, as we understand it, if you watch things like Goodfellas and Casino, the modern mafia start out with in the era of Al Capone. And Prohibition taught them everything they knew. By that, it's important to remember that Italian-American gangsters make up just a slice of the whole picture. There were Irish gangsters, Dutch gangsters, Jewish gangsters, and African-American gangsters, to name a few. So it's not really, and despite what you might think and see in Scorsese films, it's not really an exclusively Italian or Sicilian game. And if we're talking about criminals, you have to remember that a large chunk of the population who had a drink secretly anyway were criminalised by the law. I mean, criminality really exists where the law says it does, by expanding things, that categories of things we deem to be criminal or subversive. Alcohol consumption fell from 2.6 gallons per person per year in 1917 to 1 gallon by 1933. Arrests for drunkenness fell. Deaths from alcoholism fell. There were few drunk drivers. The roads were safer. And the massive expansion of motor transport meant that this was obviously a significant factor. There were many, many more roads than cars. There were fewer accidents in the workplace, when we talk about Taylorism and all that. And so, whilst Prohibition can be seen as a kind of like a failed experiment, there were elements that were positive to removing alcohol from society. Hoover sets up the Wickersham Commission in 1929 to investigate whether Prohibition has been effective. And it comes about 14 volumes later and 19 months later and says that it's unenforceable and a total waste of time. It says basically that citizens violated the Act all the time, the Volstead Act all the time, and that bootleggers and distributors were becoming extremely rich, and it's thought that it took up 66% of all law enforcement activities, and it was a massive drain on the law enforcement budget. But the members of the Wickersham Commission couldn't quite agree, and couldn't quite eventually say to Hoover that the law should be axed. So it was eventually Roosevelt that drops the axe in 1933 and creates the 20th Amendment. And the 20th Amendment said it was the responsibility of individual states to decide on the issue. And so it was a way of the federal government, A, cutting its own power, but B, also saying, oh, you know, I'll shunt the problem onto the states. States are constantly demanding that they want more of their own powers back from federal government. Well, this headache of a problem means that they can have them. Okay, so this is, I've gone on way too long, so I'm going to end it there. I hope you found that really useful, especially if you're studying this. If you can, get on to our iTunes page, the Explaining History thing on iTunes. Give us a review, preferably a good one, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. We'll try if we can do a couple of reviews later on today. All the best. Bye-bye.